Hear that? Believe it or not, summer is just around the corner. Luckily, Armor All, America's most trusted auto appearance brand, has what your car needs to get that perfect summer shine. Plus, now through May 31st, we'll give you $5 for every $20 you spend on Armor All products. That means car wash pods, protectant, tire shine, you name it. Find out how to get your $5 rebate at ArmorAll.com. Armor All. Less work, more clean. Terms apply.
This episode is brought to you by ServiceNow, the AI platform for business transformation. AI is only as powerful as the platform it's built into. Enter ServiceNow. It puts AI to work for people, for employees, for developers, and even your customers, removing frustration and supercharging productivity. On our intelligent platform, AI isn't just a promise. It's happening today. That's why the world works with ServiceNow. To learn more, visit servicenow.com/AI for people.
With threats to our nation waiting around every corner, adaptability is more important than ever. When conditions change without notice, quick strategic thinking is crucial. And with obstacles consistently impending, determination is essential in overcoming them. It's this willingness, decisiveness, and resilience that sets Marines apart. With our fighting spirit, we don't just fight battles, we win them. Marines are the constant our nation counts on to fight the unknown. And through adaptable problem solving, we do just that. Learn more at Marines.com.
Mary redeemed a $50,000 cash prize playing Chumba Casino this year.
I was only playing for fun, so winning this was a dream come true.
Chumba Casino is America's number one social casino experience. It's serious fun. With over 80 casino-style games to choose from, you too could win life-changing amounts of cash. Be like Mary. Log on to ChumbaCasino.com and give them a whirl. That's ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void or prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. The voice in the preceding commercial was not the actual voice of a winner.
It's the Autosport Podcast. Gary Anderson delivers his verdict on the second day of pre-season testing from Barcelona. Ferrari continued to top the timesheets in pre-season testing on day two here in Barcelona, with Charles Leclerc fastest on his first day in the new SF90. And just to add to the symmetry, Lando Norris ensured McLaren was second fastest again, 0.3 seconds slower, with Kevin Magnussen's Haas third. So we've got the same three teams in the top three day two as on day one, although outright lap times are of questionable meaning at this stage. I'm your host, Ed Strew, and joining me as usual is Gary Anderson for our daily testing podcast. I'd say, Gary, thanks for resisting the temptation for a plunge in the swimming pool rather than joining us on the podcast.
Well, I couldn't get the ice off the top of it to begin with. It's a bit chilly out there, I must admit. So,
I think you're a bit worried about that automatic lawnmower that's marauding nearby.
Yeah, it's amazing. It was going around the lawn this morning when we left at, 7 o'clock or something, and it's going around the lawn tonight when we come back about 7 o'clock. So it's got its lights on now at least, so that's not too bad.
It's very diligent. I did think it was going to end up in the swimming pool this morning, actually.
Amazing device, because when we head it out, it was heading towards its docking station to get a charge built up. So that's electric technology to a new level, isn't it? It's fantastic watching it. How good it is at cutting lawns, I don't know. It doesn't look robust enough to me, but it's doing the job.
Well, it's done more mileage than Williams has so far at testing, so
a lot more mileage. We'll not go there.
We'll give it credit. Well, we talked about Williams lots in the first two podcasts, the preview and the day one podcast, and then the latest is the car may arrive overnight, so we may see the Williams tomorrow. We won't talk about that too much today, but yeah, they're still working on it. So, Gary, Charles Leclerc fastest again, a 1 minute 18.247 for Leclerc on the compound three tyres, so that's kind of in the middle. They're compounds 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. One is the hardest, five is the softest. This isn't what they're going to be called officially during the year. They'll pick three of them and they'll be soft, medium and hard. So it'll be a bit more sensible once we get into the proper season. But Ferrari reeling off the lap. Charles Leclerc on his first day in the Ferrari, picking up where Sebastian Vettel left off yesterday.
Yeah, he did a very good job. And as I say, today he became an official Ferrari driver. It's his first, you know, big day. He's tested the car before and ran the car before, and obviously as a Ferrari driver. But the day you get in the car and steer it out of the garage as your official driver, that's the day you can sort of think, I've got it, I'm here. It's been his ambition for a long time. So, you know, again, today was about, you know, not blotting your copybook, just keep it neat and tidy and clean. He did a good job. He was a tenth of a second slower than what Vettel did yesterday on the same tyre. So no big drama. It looked like a sort of mirror image, really, of what the programme they went through yesterday. Bits of long runs, bits of short runs. We don't know the fuel loads, but I'm sure that both, you know, for the team point of view, I'm sure Vettel and Leclerc are running through the same sort of fuel load program, entire program, because it's important that you get both drivers to be contributing towards the car's performance, so that your development direction can be sort of summed up, between the two comments, but also hopefully in line with each other. So if they're going in different directions, suddenly it becomes a big drama. And if you've got two different programs, it can very easily go in two different directions. So he did a good job. Again, you did an article in Autosport about Leclerc not being very good at putting together his three section times. And again,
that was last season. Yeah, we looked at, you get the three sector times, you can combine them in qualifying to come up with a theoretical perfect lap. I was looking at the numbers with Corinne Chandhok earlier today, and yeah, no one managed it less often than Leclerc, only did it three times, whereas the standard setter was actually Sebastian Vettel, who did it 11 times last year. So just a little guide of who's nailing the optimum lap.
Well, I mean, that's the thing about it. Today, with his best run as such, or his best lap, he didn't put the three section times together either. He lost 0.21 of a second in the first sector. And on the second lap, he picked that up again. So you've got to put the three together. You know, come qualifying Saturday afternoon in Melbourne, those 0.2 of a second potentially are a massive amount of grid positions. So he's got to make sure that he can do that. Now, he's had a go today, and if he's smart enough, he'll have read your article, Ed, for a start, but he'll also, you know, be thinking about that tonight, because you've got to do that. You've got to make sure that you recognise your problems and then try to identify them, how you rectify them and fix, you know, get on with it. Because, as I say, qualifying on that one set of tyres or whatever, maybe two sets of tyres that you have for Q3 in Melbourne and all the future races, you've got to make the best of them, or else you'll be down the grid and then you're starting at a deficit before the race even starts.
Yeah, I'm sure he's very well aware of that relative weakness, but I think on average he was about 0.135 off his optimum lap, and that can easily be a row on the grid. So it's important, particularly up against Sebastian Vettel. But 157 laps completed for Ferrari, and I think the fact they're top of the times doesn't mean they're far and away the fastest, because we haven't seen a Mercedes at full pelt or a Red Bull, but you just look for a team just hitting the ground running, reeling off the laps, everything's working, the laps are being done. And I imagine that the whole spirit of the team, same as it was yesterday, just generally delighted with life.
Well, yeah, the thing about it, the important thing about it, is you drive out of the garage in the morning, you stop it at lunchtime, you do a little bit of a fiddle around it, you start it up after lunchtime, and you stop it at night. If you can do that, then, you know, you're running through your programme. You might even have the luxury of running through a bigger programme, which is, you know, the laps count, to be honest. You'll always learn something, even if it's just, you know, 10 laps on a hard tyre with a different fuel load to see what the degradation is like, or you try the weight distribution just that little bit different just for a 10-lap run. That's what you're doing at the test meeting. It's trying to do the things that you can't do at a race meeting, so that if at a race meeting you have this problem pop up with the fact that, you know, you're destroying the front tyres or destroying the rear tyres, or the car's got an understeer or the car's got an oversteer, you've got your data bank to relate to. And, well, when we're in Barcelona, we did this, you know, and that created that problem, which should create a fix for that problem. So, you know, that's what it is. You're just creating a huge data bank to make sure that you can address any problems that arrive when you've got the constraints of a race weekend. And the more laps you can do, the more you get out of it.
Well, let's look down to second place. Lando Norris on his first day in the McLaren on the C4 compound, so the one in from the softest. He did a 1 minute 18.553. That was very late on. He put in that lap time. Now, McLaren fans might be looking at that and getting quite excited, thinking, oh, McLaren's back. Not necessarily right up the front, but got a good, strong car. What do you think? There's a bit of a danger, there's a bit of an illusion going on here, isn't there?
Well, I think, you know, both yesterday with Carlos Sainz and today with Lando Norris, they're making the last hour into a happy hour, as we used to call it. You know, and it's right to do, to be honest, especially for Lando Norris, because the most important thing is that he gets to Melbourne feeling comfortable with going into qualifying, that he knows what the car will do with low fuel and new tyres on it. He knows how, you know, he has to attack the lap. So there's nothing wrong with that. Maybe it's early in the test to do it, but, you know, you've only got a limited amount of time. So Carlos Sainz had a go at it yesterday. Probably he doesn't really need to do it. He's got some experience. Lando Norris had a go at it today. He does need to do it because he hasn't got the experience. So nothing wrong with doing it. But it's just, you know, don't think that that is the performance of the car relative to everybody else. I'm pretty sure that we'll see 16s of some sort, 1 minute 16 second lap times around here before the end of even this first test. Fairly ambitious, but last year we got a 1 minute 17.2. I think the track's in better condition this year. I think the weather's better condition this year. Yes, they've lost a little bit of downforce because of the front wing change, but the characteristics of the cars look a lot better than they did last year. So I think that'll make up for that. So I would be surprised if, you know, the mid 1 minute 16s isn't the ultimate lap time, which, you know, will come from a bigger team. So don't think that's the McLaren pace just yet. Very impressive. They needed to recover from last year. They've done a good job. The car looks good. It goes round and round and round. Very important. And so, you know, all the best to them. They need to do it.
I think with McLaren, it's all about what the expectations and the objectives need to be. Because for me, McLaren just needs to have a car that works reasonably well, show they can develop it through the season, prove that those technical changes they've made have worked. And I don't think McLaren's going to be a top five in the Constructors' Championship this year. And I think if you look at the long-run pace, that we're starting to see a few hints of that. It didn't look anything extraordinary. But that might sound like being negative about McLaren, but it's also being realistic. I think we may slightly disagree on what McLaren could aim to do in 1 year, but it feels to me like this is last year was the rude awakening, and now this is the steadying the ship year and the showing that the course you've set is the right one, even if you're not going super quick in that direction.
Yeah, I agree completely. And also the fact that it's probably better to be the learning year, or the stabilising year, as you call it, because it's, if you can go from being in the doldrums they were last year to being in the top three, let's say, next year or this year, you have to ask the question, why? Because and that's hard to answer. You know, we all do lots and lots and lots of work. And the way I look at racing cars is they're, you know, there's no team in the pit lane that actually genuinely knows 100% of what makes the car work. It's just the good teams know a little bit more. But there's still a certain percentage of the car that you can make an error on. And let's say, just for example, that Mercedes over the last, you know, 5 years have been pretty dominant. They probably know 80% of what makes the car faster on the racetrack. So there's still 20% that they can make a mistake on. And for McLaren, you know, they probably know 60%. So there's 40% they can make a mistake on. And the important thing is to try to eliminate those potential mistakes. Make sure you know why you're bad, or make sure you know why you're good, because then you want to try and improve that. So they need to have a stable year, and they need to try and get the best out of the car they can. The car looks okay. You know, I don't think it's got the grip of some of the other cars. The rear looks a little nervous now and again, going into the corner and on the throttle. But not exceptional, just that little bit. And you pick these little bits out that you see. And that's where McLaren is, just the rear of the car a little bit.
Well, we should remember that at this stage last year, they were having problems with wheels falling off, and that rear instability that was there all year was starting to manifest itself. I think we were both watching the chicane when it started to show up with Van Dorn driving. So, yeah, it's solid for McLaren, but McLaren fans shouldn't get too excited just yet. Yesterday, we didn't talk too much about Haas. We did quite a whistle-stop tour of everyone. Kevin Magnussen, third fastest, 1 minute 19.206 on the C3 compound. So that's the middle compound of tyres. Now, he was a little bit restricted on running today because he had a problem with the headrest configuration, whereby the headrest was pushing his head forward. So then when he was on the brakes, it was really, really difficult. That's quite an unusual problem, really, for I understand how that can happen, but this is his third year with the team. So how does something like that happen? The headrest rules haven't changed.
No, it's a configuration, really. First of all, you've got the seat, and then you've got the hands device that the drivers have to wear, which is sort of like a horseshoe that fits around your shoulders, and the helmet gets strapped back to it, and it gets trapped with the seatbelt, so that in a head-on impact, basically it doesn't overextend your neck. And then you got the headrest, and obviously somewhere along the line they got the configuration of those wrong. So the hands device was getting caught up in the headrest and pushing his head forward. And it's very uncomfortable because, you say, you know, under braking, you're sort of, your head moves, but your head moves further than what you want it to be. And so, yeah, rather than sort of pulling a muscle or a ligament or whatever in your neck, it's better to stop a bit earlier, which is what he did. And he limited his laps during the day as well, just to make sure he didn't hurt himself, because it's once you've damaged some of the ligaments in your neck, you know, Melbourne will still be painful. So better to be careful and wait a little bit. Maybe it's just a sitting position in the car. You know, if he had his able to move his seat forward a little bit, or a bit of a thicker seat, his head would come away from the headrest. But maybe the car configuration with the steering wheel position and stuff isn't quite right. So I'm sure they'll fix it. But he's a reasonably tall guy. These cars have got a seat back to pedal dimension that they are, seat back to front bulkhead dimension that you have to comply with at 1.8 metres. So it should be okay for him, but somewhere along the line, he's just seemed to be a bit constrained within the car.
But another solid day's work for Haas, notwithstanding that. Car looks like it's going okay on track, doesn't it? So it's, again, not the third fastest, but certainly Haas looking, at least in the ballpark, to do what they did last year.
Yeah, I went out around the track again today, and turn 9 is one of these corners, a very fast right-hander at the top of the hill. It's a sort of blind corner, Campsa. So it's a good place to look at the back of the cars and see how stable they are. And I have to say the Haas was quite impressive through there. It looked neat and tidy. And, you know, the most important thing is that the rear doesn't move as you go over the top of that bit of a hill. And some of the cars, you could just see that little bit of movement. But the Haas did look well planted, well, you know, secure and confident. So they're a team that's growing. They're you know, they're going to be a pain in the backside to a few of the other midfield teams. Can they close the gap on the top three, as we call it? It's going to be tough. It's going to really be tough still. But we have to just wait and see how it all unfolds in Melbourne.
Well, fourth fastest was Alexander Albon, 1 minute 19.301 on the C4 tyre. So that's the one in from the softest. Big day for him. It's his first Formula One test, going straight into the pre-season test programme. So out you go, first thing in the morning. Coming out the fifth corner, you're sat in the gravel facing the wrong way. We have heard drivers talking about how difficult the tyres are, the tyre warmer, because they have lowered the temperature you can warm the tyres to. Obviously, early in the morning, although the temperature got higher later on, it was still cold. So I'm sure it was a very embarrassing moment for him, but I guess you have to have some sympathy for how that can happen.
Yeah, you do. I mean, it was his first drive, so it was pretty tricky. It didn't damage the car or anything really worth talking about, just maybe little bits of carbon fibre underneath it. But yeah, they've lowered the rear temperature on the rear tyres to a maximum of 80 degrees, and you're still allowed to warm the front tyres up to 100 degrees. Now, in saying that, you know, that shouldn't make the fact the guy goes out and spins. Grosjean's done it. We've had a few cars do it. Kimi Raikkonen did it yesterday. So it's a little bit more than just the fact that the tyre temperatures, to be honest, that's going on there.
The offset plays a part.
Yeah, the offset of the tyre temperature. But there's a little bit more to it than that, I'm sure. And basically, you know, the rear of the car, you can normally warm up any time, the throttle, you know, and spin the wheels. And a lot of the teams would just stop at the end of the pit lane and do a practice start, and that means the rear tyres are going up like 20 degrees immediately. So the only reason you spin is because, you know, the rear tyres are cool. And that's a bit negligent, I suppose, especially first thing in the morning when it is cold. You know, if you get the rear tyres too hot, then the car understeers a bit, because the front tyres are very difficult to get up to temperature or get to working. Temperature is a loose word. Front tyres are very difficult to get to working. So it's a balance that between the two. But first thing in the morning, when it's a bit cold here, which it is, it might be better just to get those rear tyres working and live with that understeer for a lap or two until you get your eye in a bit. But he didn't do that. Ended up in the gravel trap. Blotted his copybook, but he got away with it.
Things got better after that for him, though, didn't he? A lot of laps, total of 132 laps, which is a pretty big workload for your first day in F1 cars. So I think even though that mistake happened, it's understandable and it's forgivable, isn't it? And he got on with the job. He clearly didn't let it affect him too much.
Yeah, they did say something about a steering problem. I'm not sure how related that is, or if that was just sort of trying to not get him too down and out on his first day in a Formula One car, because sometimes it's better for the team to sort of maybe say, well, there's a little bit of a problem here, like the hydraulic pressure on the steering wasn't quite right or something. Just as a confidence boost to the guy, because obviously that's, you know, you can definitely get somebody so nervous about it all that they'd go out and do the same thing again. So sometimes you have to put your arm around the guy's shoulder. I didn't used to do that much, but sometimes you do have to do that.
Put the arm around the throat or something.
Well, thumb marks in the throat I always find work well.
I'm just checking because obviously it's not long after testing's finished, so our team at the track's still there. So having a look at what Alexander Albon said about it, and he said, at the start, I was thinking to myself, don't spin it this morning. And that's exactly what I did. Really tricky out there. The track was so cold that you couldn't drive slowly. As soon as you drive too slow, your tyres get too cold. It becomes unpredictable, and it's like driving on ice. But then, as he says, after, once I got into my rhythm, it was a smooth day and we had no issues. So certainly he made up for it. And what we've seen plenty of drivers have a mishap like that. It's just unfortunate for him that it happens to be a high-profile moment in the pre-season test. But yeah, still a good day. Let's jump around a little bit. Antonio Giovinazzi was fifth fastest in the Alfa Romeo woman at 19.312 on the C4 compound. And we won't talk about Sauber too much today. We talked about them a little yesterday with Kimi Räikkönen. But actually, I spoke to Kimi Räikkönen earlier today for a future article in Autosport. And he seemed very, very cheerful with life and happy, both with the surroundings and the way the car's working. So that's positive for Alfa Romeo, the renamed Sauber team. And then sixth fastest, we've got the Mercedes, Valtteri Bottas. Again, they split the day. Bottas ended up with a faster lap time, a 1 minute 19.535 on the C3s. And again, Mercedes doing what they always do, still running on relatively high fuel loads and just going through their program. And there don't seem to have been any particular causes for alarm from Mercedes. I know Lewis Hamilton said that the car feels a little bit different to last year's car, so clearly it has changed in some ways, which is good because they will have been aiming to change it for the better. But Mercedes kind of keeping below the radar and just doing what they're doing. I don't think anyone thinks they're struggling particularly.
No, I don't think they are, but you know they do normally and at some point in time show their hand, because I think it's important that you do that. They haven't done that yet. The car does look like it's reasonably heavy, you know, doing long runs and nothing you would get too excited about. But sometime you have to make sure. And Ferrari, I don't think, are running, you know, low fuel either. I think, you know, the car doesn't look like it's on low fuel.
I think it's more lower fuel. Yeah. A lot of teams will have their set amount they run. So, yeah, I don't think anyone's suggesting Ferrari's, glory running or anything. It's just, that's their program.
Whenever you look at fuel weight, I mean, 10 kilograms of fuel is basically 3/10 of a second. So 30 kilograms of fuel knocking on the door of a second slower or take it out a second faster. So they can have a big influence on lap time. But as I said earlier, I'm expecting the cars to get into the 16s, which if you take that from the 18-1 that Vettel did, 18-2 that Leclerc did, you know, you're talking about them actually running something in the region of 50 kilograms of fuel at the moment, which I think if I was planning something now with a fuel load of 110 kilograms that the cars carry, I would do most of my work around the mid-range fuel, 55 kilograms, because, you know, fill it to the full, you kill the tyres too quickly. Have it empty, you're just deluding yourself. So I don't think you have to be a brain surgeon to realise that maybe mid-fuel tanks-ish would be a good place to be. And maybe, you know, if you're doing a bit of a run, just go from 70 down to 40, but don't go from 110 to 80. Just use that little middle window, and then you get a better reading on everything. And I'm sure both Ferrari and Mercedes aren't far away from that, but maybe Mercedes have got, you know, 20 more kilograms or maybe even 30 in it at the moment.
Well, next down the order, we see Pierre Gasly, his first official day as a Red Bull racing driver, as it were. He did a 1 minute 19.814 on the C3 compound. Now, he did have a bit of a mishap in turn 11, the long right-hander. So talk us through that moment he had. It was caught on the coverage.
Well, actually, interesting. I think it was 2 years ago, Max Verstappen had a similar moment coming out of that turn 12 and smacked the barrier on the outside of the track. It might even been last year, but anyway, it could happen to the best as well. But yeah, he was, you know, he just on a fresh set of tyres, and he did his best midsection time just coming out of turn 10, his little kink, which he called turn 11. Just the rear stepped out that little bit on it, just a little bit of wheel spin. And then in the fact that at the same point in time he had to turn right, for turn 12 and sort of add the correction to the oversteer as well. The sort of momentum just took him around and into the tyre barrier or the protection barrier backwards. No big deal. And again, it's a bit like Albon at the beginning of the day, you know, just putting your arm around his shoulder and making sure he doesn't get too down about it, because he's obviously more fed up with that happening than anybody. He didn't do the car lots of damage, I don't believe, although, you know, maybe they don't have lots of spares either, brand new car. But you, this point in time, you know, he blotted his copybook a little bit. What Red Bull will be saying to him sort of is, you know, don't do it again. Once, yeah, okay, we'll give you the benefit of the doubt. But he stood up and said it was my fault, just lost the rear a little bit, and, you know, that's it, you're a passenger. So no big deal, but, you know, don't do it too often.
Well, in terms of others in the wars, Renault had a few problems today. Daniel Ricciardo had a problem related to the DRS and the top flap of the rear wing broken and came off on the main straight. In fact, we had in our live coverage Luke Hinsel of Motorsport TV is here with us. I can see him editing one of our videos that'll be out as you listen to this in the kitchen. He snapped a few Renault personnel bringing it back, and you could see the brake was very much in the middle. So can you explain what happened there and why it was a DRS failure, system failure that led to that happening?
Well, yes, I mean, I can explain as best I think I can. Basically, the DRS this year opens 20 millimetres more. There's 20 millimetres more slot gap through to allow more airflow through, so the drag reduction is more. At the same point in time, the downforce that the rear wing will be producing is less. So a few bits of calculation about the speed increase and stuff. You're talking about 450 or 500 kilograms of downforce you're losing off the back of the car when you have the DRS open. Because of opening that a bit further now, the flap can get into the point where it goes past its aerodynamic center. In other words, it's trying to actually open further, and the DRS is keeping it from doing that. The DRS mechanism is keeping it from doing that because there's a little hydraulic actuator there that last year a lot of teams just had the hydraulic actuator opening the wing and allowing a spring to shut it because it never got near its aerodynamic center, other than Ericsson at Monza when he had a big crash in the Sauber where the flap, again, because of the low downforce, the flap was too open, it didn't shut. But now, basically, 20 millimetres more, it can get to its aerodynamic centre, and that can be because the actuator is having to hold the wing in the wrong direction, the flap in the wrong direction, or the fact that if it's just sitting on its aerodynamic centre, it will create a vibration where the airflow doesn't know whether to shut it or open it, so you get a vibration in the rear wing flap, which I would now say was probably the reason that it failed. It was just fatigue because the little flap sitting there bouncing up and down. So it fatigues and just, that said, it breaks. So one way of stopping it is to just not open it quite as far for now, put some sort of stop mechanism inside the actuator. Just make sure you got pressure on it in the closing direction. Or as they did with Hülkenberg for the rest of the day, didn't open it again, just left it shut, which, yeah, is another solution.
And looking at the Renault pace otherwise, Nico Hülkenberg was 8th, 1 minute 19.837 on the C3s, and Ricciardo 9th, 1 minute 19.886 on the C3s. They split the day, so to within half a tenth the same times. We've not seen anything particularly exciting from the Renaults as yet, other than rear wings flying off. So are you a little bit concerned about what they are, or do you think we just put that down as they're just running to their programme and don't need to do anything flashy?
Looking at the car on the track, it's not doing anything wrong, but then neither is any of them. Just the corner speed is a bit different, and that's just down to the grip level you have, downforce level you have, and the tyres you got in the car, all that sort of stuff. But in general, I don't think they've got the grip level of the Ferrari or the top teams. Confusing that with fuel loads, obviously, it's very difficult, but Hülkenberg did a long run today, and just watching him, the car through that long run just was okay, but it just went slower because of the fuel load. So it's difficult because we can only compare like for like on the track, and we don't know the fuel loads of any of the cars. But I wouldn't have said I see anything impressive from the Renault just yet that's going to move them out of that midfield bunch. You know, there's that what we call the top three, and then there's a gap, and then there's the midfield bunch. At the front of that midfield bunch, at the minute, I would have said the Haas is probably the strongest car, the strongest package that I'm seeing. Between them and Sauber, I think, is the big battle at the moment. Now, Force India have got some room to move forward. Renault have got some room to move forward. And, you know, Toro Rosso. But I'm not sure that I'm seeing just the out-and-out performance yet. We just have to wait and see who brings what developments before the end of this test. But I'd say at the minute, if I was to make a judgment, Sauber and Haas are looking reasonably strong for taking the mantle of that top four.
And it's interesting, looking at the pace of the Renault, sort of back-of-the-envelope calculations of various ones they're doing, it's not looking like the gap to Red Bull, who were the obvious comparison. They were good comparison last year because it was fourth overall, not necessarily fourth fastest, against third. So the gap's sort of looking fairly similar. So that's maybe a little bit concerning. But what else do we have? Yeah, Lewis Hamilton was 10th at 1 minute 19.928 on the C3s, ahead of Lance Stroll, who had his first proper outing for Racing Point of this year, 1 minute 20.433, also on the C3s. And actually, we should mention Pietro Fittipaldi took over the Haas at the end and had a handful of laps getting down to a time in that, who, of course, is the Haas test driver. So that completes the 12 drivers who were running today. There was some off-track news. The FIA released this, what's been called a spec gearbox contract that's been out for tender. Now, it's a little bit more complicated than that, isn't it? Because the proposal is for a cassette which will contain the gearbox internals that then slots in, and so that's a common thing supplied by whoever. There's been suggestions X-Track is a quite obvious contender to maybe supply that sort of thing, but there's many others. Any of the teams, of course, could tender for that. And then that slots into the gearbox casing that the team has to design itself, and that kind of makes the gearbox kind of almost a rear chassis type thing, but then I think the things that's bolted onto the monocoque and then the wheels and everything, the rear wheels are attached to. So to call it just a spec gearbox is slightly oversimplifying it. And obviously this came as some news. I think my colleague Adam Cooper mentioned the tender was out to Günther Steiner of Haas this morning down in the paddock, and I think Steiner knew this was not possibly on the agenda. I don't think anyone had told some of the teams that this was actually out. So interesting proposal, and it's all caught up in the politics, isn't it? Because there's the desire to kind of keep costs under control with the control element, but also making sure teams are designing their own cars. So if you're Haas, you've never made a gearbox in their life, they just take it wholesale from Ferrari. Likewise, other teams, Racing Point, take a Mercedes box. We have seen teams in the past, not this year, Toro Rosso is running a full Red Bull gearbox now, but in the past it's done its own casing and then the internals have slotted in. But there's several teams that currently aren't making gearbox casings that would have to. And if you're making a gearbox casing in carbon fibre, which all but Williams, as of last year, certainly, that's very expensive. So it's all wrapped up in this listed parts, non-listed parts argument, and it's kind of taking with one hand in terms of trying to save the cost of the internals, but kind of giving with another by adding cost with the casing. So complicated.
Yeah, it's complicated. The one thing I have to say is the main structure carries a rear suspension. So in other words, you call it a sort of a casing there, which would be carbon fibre on most cars, if this is the way it goes, would just be a shell as such, a structural shell, a bit like the chassis itself. So most teams have the facility to make that. The difficult part of that, making that component as a gearbox, becomes the gearbox part, doing all the gearbox internals and stuff. So now, currently, what we have is that Sauber and Haas use Ferrari gearbox and probably most of rear suspension. And we've got Racing Point, who use a Mercedes gearbox. And we've got Toro Rosso, who use the Red Bull gearbox. So there's a sort of precedent set that, some teams don't want to design their own gearbox. They have a facility to buy a gearbox from somebody else. And they go that route because it allows their smaller staff levels to do more work on the thing that makes the car perform, which is the aerodynamics. So good, bad, or different, it's a solution to that problem. It would mean that the team would have to make its own gearbox or its own rear casing to mount the suspension, so it would more or less have to make its own suspension. And the gearbox internals would be this cassette that plugs in there, and there's some type of a drive. I imagine the teams would do the differential themselves and the output shafts and drive shafts and stuff housed into their carbon fibre casing. and that the cassette would push in there with a, you know, male-female spline of some sort to drive it. So not a stupid idea as far as that whole thing is concerned. The stupid idea from my point of view is that we saw the tender being released today and they want people to tender for it by the 14th of March. To do that job correctly, we'll take and come up with a figure that's practical for the solution, because obviously all the teams would like to see it to cut costs, all the teams would buy into it if it didn't hurt their performance and would cut costs. So you've got to do your cost analysis fairly well, and you've got 4 weeks, 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks to do all that. It's nigh on impossible in my book. So I think it's not a bad idea to propose, but it needs a longer term to actually get a proper, solid proposal. Otherwise, it'll end up like things like HS2 or the London Underground or whatever it is. They're doing tunnels and stuff where it costs 10 times as much as what we thought it was. So, get all that stuff done, but give the people that are going to do the tender an opportunity to do a proper tender, and then it might make sense in the longer term.
Especially seeing as they have time, because this is for 2021. I should have said, and it's not coming in next year, so there is a little bit of time. It's part of that big rule change. So, yeah, interesting to see what the reaction is to this.
I think it might be firing a shot over the bows of saying to the teams, look, chaps, we do need to do something with this.
It's not Max Mosley tactic, isn't it? It's like throw out the rules and then say, well, if you don't like that, come up with another compromise
solution.
Yeah,
come up with a solution. And the solution could be, just cut costs, basically. As a team, you want to make the best you can. And as Ferrari or Mercedes or Red Bull, say those big teams that have the biggest budgets, they want to have the best solution to any given problem they can. And money doesn't really stand in the way. So the technology they would use for the gearbox, it may cost them a couple of million extra to do that, or much more than that, but to do the whole project is many millions for a gearbox. But, there may be some trick inside it that means it's a couple of million dollars extra. They won't say no to that because they have it. They can do it. But then for a smaller team to try and do the same thing, it's not possible. So this would be a way of getting some equality within the gearbox. But I never think that Formula One should go to a one-make formula. And the more you do of that stuff, the more you're heading in that direction, to be honest. And I don't think it's right. But as I say, I genuinely believe it's a shot over the bows of, we are going to do something here. And if you don't buck up with teams and try and cut your own costs and try to work within yourselves, then we will do something.
Yeah, I think there's definitely going to be some fallout from this. Interesting to follow how that gets along. Well, thanks very much, Gary Anderson, for your insight on the second day of testing. You'll, of course, be back tomorrow with more comments and trackside observations as things start to take shape. Please do check out autosport.com. Lots of news from goings-on at Barcelona and all the rest of the world of motorsport on there. Our live text coverage has been running throughout the day, all sorts of pictures and insight and analysis, some Gary comments in there as well. So follow that once testing gets back underway on Wednesday. And do check out our Plus subscriber area. We've got some in-depth features for a small fee. You can access some of the world's leading motorsport journalists. Of course, Gary Anderson writes on there. Jake Boxall-Legg, our technical editor, has been looking into front wings and the different concepts that have been approached so far. So you can have a look there to read in depth about that. Please check out sister titles, motorsport.com, F1 Racing Magazine, out monthly, and Motorsport News, out every Wednesday. And if you fancy a flutter, download the Pit Stop Betting app. Thanks for joining us. We'll be back soon with another Autosport podcast. Music is 6 AM by Trelo, written by Marcus Simmons. See soundcloud.com/Trelo Music.
With the Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
I love the playoffs. Anything can happen. But the best part? It's like bonus football. And bonus football means betting bonuses with Gambit DC. For a limited time, you can get boosted deposits by 57%, up to $1,000 on the Gambit DC app, and up to a 57% multi-sport parlay boost at Gambit DC retail locations. It's the most exciting time to be a fan, so make your play and get the home field advantage with Gambit DC. Limited time offer, terms and conditions apply. Please bet responsibly.
Sports Social Podcast Network.